Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're in the midst of a conversation with Al, who had called in from Tampa, talking about our misuse and misappropriation of the military, spending too much making enemies, really, with our military, as opposed to using what resources we have to make friends. And I asked Al to stay over until the beginning of this hour so that he could complete his thought. Go ahead, Al. You were talking about your involvement in the military long ago in Asia.
Yes, a few countries over there. I even climbed up Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. And
You weren't there, though, during the Battle of Iwo Jima, were you?
Oh, no.
No, you're not that old. No. So you did this after World War II, probably were you serving during the time of Korea, after Korea, Vietnam, Vietnam?
Well, after. I tell you right now, okay. I thank Yahweh every day that I did not ever have to kill another man.
And, yeah, you'd imagine being that being on Iwo Jima or any one of those Pacific islands, and the idiocy of our government saying that we're going to send men to die by the thousands, and sometimes by the tens of thousands. Yeah, for what reason? Yeah, for what reason? I mean, that war at that time, after we just got lucky at the Battle of the Coral Sea, I mean, we just got lucky. By every matter of reason, we should have lost the battle. We were outgunned. We just got lucky. But after we got lucky there and essentially broke the back of the Japanese Navy, there was no reason at that time to sacrifice tens of thousands of American lives. A war of attrition would have brought the desired result, and there was no reason to sacrifice those lives, and it's just a tragedy to me that we did so. And not only those who died there for nothing, really, but also for those who survived and having to carry with them the idea hand-to-hand combat in many cases, or pulling the trigger when they're looking at somebody taking another person's life, as they did. You know, it's a horrible thing to have to live with thereafter, so I'm glad you weren't there.
Yes, and a lot of people I do know have to deal with that every day, forever. And my thing is that, going to different countries, well, my mindset going in, you know, we have this pride feeling going in the Marine Corps, this, this, and that, and once you get in, and my mentality, I mean, the way I grew up, I mean, I questioned things and made my bumps along the way, and I'm not a robot. Never had that mentality, and so I didn't have a very long career.
But you mentioned one of the things, though, that's scary, and that is that the whole mindset of the Marine Corps is pride. And, you know,
absolutely,
pride is a really debilitating attribute. When you have pride, when you think you're better than someone else, tougher, stronger, you know, more deadly, particularly the pride in the Marine Corps, more deadly than someone else, that's a really bad mindset. It might be a great mindset for killing, but it's a horrible mindset in terms of for a person to have. Yeah, it's the mindset that drove Muhammad. It's the mindset that drove Paul. It's debilitating. You become someone whom Yahweh cannot even reach. You become someone who has no chance whatsoever of availing yourself of the covenant or the offers of salvation that Yahweh provides, if in fact your perspective is prideful.
Word is as far as vibe goes, and when you're in that vibe and that mentality and being around people that are pumped up and.
Right.
You know, it's contagious. And
gang mentality. Gang mentality.
Absolutely.
You know, like, you know, well an individual, you know, won't go off and kill somebody if they can avoid it. A gang will. Yeah.
Yeah.
The behaviors that we manifest in a gang, and when you go off with a group of Marines and everybody is armed and everybody's charged up and you're all told that the people you're going to attack are less than human, you know, you'll do things that you would never do on your own.
I mean, it was a great experience to see different places, cultures, but, mm-hmm. and this is the thing that I realized, and kids are innocent, and you get to meet them, and that's nice,
right.
But, there's also, the mentality, and this is something that I had to explain to a lot of people later on in life, and we are, to these people in different countries, we are the bad guys.
Yeah, we are.
You know, we're kind of,
right.
we're two-faced. You know, one hand,
right.
we're kind of handing out some, you know, food or whatever,
right.
and then the next minute, you know, and the older one, the adults, know this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, we took the Philippines as a spoil in the Spanish-American War. This was the war that we started because we wanted to become imperialists. And as an imperialist nation, we took the Philippines as a spoil. And so there's every reason for the Filipinos to look at the American military with great suspicion. We earned that. You know, in World War II, yes, the Japanese were savage. Imperial Japan, what they did in China in terms of the mass starvations, the comfort women in Korea and China, which were military organized rapes, gang rapes of women, they were just despicable. I mean, animals. There's no question about that. But the way that we prosecuted the war and finally won was that we became a terrorist nation. We firebombed and nuked their civilian centers. You know, it's not going to endear yourself to a people when you do that sort of thing. So, you know, it's, you know, you look at the Islamic world, while, you know, Islam makes people terrorists. The religion is a terrorist manifesto. It's a horrible religion. But, you know, when you go and you send drones into homes and kill families, you know, you're going to manufacture 1,000 more enemy for everyone you kill.
Absolutely. And it's a Judge Dredd mentality. You know, propaganda. I mean, to me, propaganda
right.
is the most incredible weapon that there is, because I
yeah,
know
like,
that even in Okinawa,
yeah.
Japan, there's a clip there that, you know, the propaganda that the
right.
Japanese were telling their
right.
people was that we were giants, we're going to come and eat, rape them, just crazy.
Right.
And
right.
the virgin women jumped off the cliff. You know,
that's exactly
I mean,
right, yeah.
The fear.
And it's,
fear
and it's because
so
of
incredible.
That kind of propaganda, though, is only possible in countries that blend their religion and their politics together, and that was the nature of Imperial Japan. The emperor was seen to be a god, and the generals were the arms, the messengers of their god. And so when you blend religion and politics together, you get that kind of propaganda. It's why Jefferson was so opposed to a standing and established military. Is that he said it not only brings on taxes, it not only brings on debt, it not only brings out the worst in the moral conduct of individuals, but he says it brings on an onslaught of fraud, he didn't use the term propaganda, but the term he used is almost identical to it, that it causes a nation to be deceived in mass with this political hysteria. And you stop thinking.
I was just
you know?
About to bring up Thomas Jefferson because I do agree with you. I think he was one of the greatest minds of this country of all
mm-hmm.
time. And it's so incredible to, you know, to try to talk to people about this. And people just cannot, for lack of a better term, outside the box to reason these things out.
Right. You look at Jefferson, for example. You know, Christians have a problem with him because they claim he was a deist, and his Bible only contained the words of Yahusha. He eliminated everything Paul wrote. Everything. In fact, he wrote a friend, and he said the first to corrupt the message of Yahusha was Paul. I mean, he had it right. It was brilliant. People say, well, you know, he was a student of Islam, which is why he had a Quran. No, he had a Quran because his first mission, one with he took with Adams, was to find out why the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic Empire, was pirating American ships and keeping the crews as captive, enslaving them, and offering them back for ransom. And the ambassador for the Ottoman Empire quoted the Islamic hadith in the Quran and said, this is our religion. It's central to what we do. We're ordered to do this, and this is your fate. And so Jefferson, I said, you know, he hated religion, but he said, you know, I can't even believe that. So he acquired a copy of the Quran to find out whether or not what the Ottoman Empire was saying was true. And it is. You know.
Yes, he seeks more knowledge. And this is another thing that I'm dealing with a lot with right now with the Christian family is that, you know, if you keep looking into the same book, you're just going to, you know, you're going to be stuck in that same mindset and repeating the same mistake. And we need the definition of that. You know. It's very tough, but just trying to.
If you only listen to Paul as Paul demands, then you're going to believe Paul because you'll have no reason to disbelieve him. But if you do the right thing, which Yahweh encourages, which is to question him, and you compare what he has to say to what God has to say, because he claims he speaks on behalf of God. If you actually compare what Paul wrote and what Yahweh wrote, they are absolute opposites. And so it takes is a matter of a few hours of research to recognize that Paul's positions and Yahweh's positions are the antithesis of one another, which means that Paul lied when he claimed to speak for him. You know, but you have to be willing to question. You have to be willing to think. You know, if you're not, you know, if you're in love with your religion and if you think that questioning will weaken your religious faith, you're not going to do that.
And I look at it too, in total opposites. I mean, the good, the evil. I mean, and it's if you almost look at it that way, it, you know, the actual word of Yahweh, and then the opposite. What would the opposite of that be? And it's right there. It's right in front of our face.
Exactly.
The town
of course. If Yahweh says, I have only one covenant, that covenant has terms and conditions, and that Abraham acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, and this is why he received its benefits, and Paul says that that same covenant enslaves, is that not the opposite of it? You know, where God says that I'm giving you my Torah guidance to liberate you from human, religious, and political enslavement, and Paul says that the Torah is the means that God uses to enslave people. I mean, God says that the Torah is the means to righteousness and redemption, and Paul says no, it only condemns. They're the opposite of one another. Thank you. I'll have enjoyed this discussion. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we return to the Torah's depiction of Yahweh's conversation with Noah and how they Noah was given the opportunity to engage with Yahweh in the construction of the ark. Just as a program note, since the last discussion with Al was about the ill effects of religion. Tomorrow in the first hour, unless there's something significant that happens in the news, my plan is to address religious lunacy by way of a book that was written by Hagee. He's a evangelical Christian pastor. Wrote a book called The Four Blood Moons. And since a friend of mine was all excited about the statistical improbability of him being wrong and how wonderful this insight was, I'm going to spend the first hour, tomorrow's program, debunking the latest book by Hagee called The Four Blood Moons. Now, returning to Yahweh's discussion. As we discussed at length over the past couple of days, Yahweh created the universe and humankind for the express purpose of engaging with us. That is what he wants to do. It's what I have found in my own life, and I know I'm not unique in any way in this regard, but doing things with my sons, I did not have the good fortune of having a daughter. I had two sons. Delighted to have two sons. I'm not knocking two sons, but I just happen to have two sons. And doing things with my sons, whether it was sports or whether it was camping or whether it was things like Indian guides or Cub Scouts or Boy Scouts, that to me was really fun. In fact, I'm not I'm quite certain that there's nothing in life that is more enjoyable than doing things as a family, taking vacations and the like with one's children. Well, God likes to engage with his children as well. Now, his family is called the covenant. We're all invited to participate. There are five terms and conditions that you must act upon if you want to participate. Of course, the first of them is to walk away from religion and politics. But God did all of that and conceived his covenant and made this all possible, even conceived life, because he wants to do things with us. And that is why he didn't simply save Noah by saying, "Hell, I'll beam you up here, and your family of eight, I'll beam you up here. We'll have the flood go through Mesopotamia, and when it's all done, we'll just simply beam you on down." Yeah, he's fully capable of doing that, but that's not his style. God wants to do practical, real things together. That's why in eternity we're going to go off on a voyage of discovery. You know, it's going to be the Ark of Yah. Jump aboard. Warp speed. Here we go. So, speaking of the Ark, he says, these are her production relationships. The Ark's length shall be 300 cubits, her width shall be 50 cubits, and her height 30 cubits. Well, if you just read that and say, all right, okay. So what does that mean? Well, using the Royal Egyptian cubit known to Moshe, which was 20.6 inches, versus the future, but not yet developed, Hebrew cubit, which was 18 inches. By the way, a cubit was the easiest way to measure back in the day. Was the length of your forearm. If you lay your forearm, you know, on the ground or on a table or something, from your the back of your elbow to the tip of your longest finger, that is a cubit. Now, so the cubits were longer for the Egyptians, ever so slightly, than they were for the Hebrews. But that is the measure of a cubit. In Egypt, it would, of course, change because the Pharaoh was considered to be God. And if he was a big guy or a little guy, you know, you had a longer or shorter cubit. And everybody's cubit's slightly different. But this would have been Noah's cubit, which if we're going to use the universal measure at that time, it would be the Egyptian cubit, 20.6 inches in length. But that's how the cubit was designated. That would make the ark 515 feet long overall. Now, a 515-foot ship is not as big as some. There are boats that ships that are larger than that, like the Concordia that ran aground and flipped on its side because it was not particularly stable. You know, it's that superstructure is way too immense for the Concordia. But when it hit the rock and fell over on its side, that ship was almost 1,000 feet. But the Ark was 515 feet long overall. It had an 86-foot beam. That's a pretty massive beam. And it was 52 feet high from the keel to the roof line of the deckhouse. Now, that is to say that the engineering know-how and shipbuilding technology for a vessel this size would comfortably say was well beyond anything completed or attempted during Noah's lifetime, and that would be an understatement. But yet, these are the dimensions of a modern, stable freighter or oil carrier. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the dimensions of the Ark. There are thousands of proofs that Yahweh inspired the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and that you can trust the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You know, my favorite happens to be the fact that Yahweh told us that from his perspective during creation that it took six 24-hour days, and he rested on the seventh. And now that man has found the residue and can measure the cosmic microwave radiation emanating from the Big Bang, which, by the way, was a term that Yahweh coined. He actually called creation a Big Bang. That we find that the wavelength is stretched by 10 to the 12th power. And we know that time is not relative, excuse me, not is not relative. Time is relative, and that it moves more slowly at the presence of great energy and velocity, which is the very definition of the Big Bang. And that if you do the math and you recognize that wavelength was stretched 10 to the 12th power, and you divide the 14 to 15 billion years since this creative event by the 10 to the 12th factor, you find that you get 6 24-hour Earth days. It's those kind of things that just are so stunningly revealing. Along with the fact that each progressive event is precisely as God said it was, and that the what science has been able to affirm and what the Torah testimony is, they're in absolute perfect sync as we go through those 6 days. Well, this is a small one amongst big ones, but the fact is that the dimensions of the Ark are completely different than the dimensions of seaworthy vessels at that time, and are completely consistent with tankers and freighters today. So now that we're 5,000 years more advanced technologically, let's compare the Ark's dimension to the kinds of ships most similar to it today. The USS Nimitz was designed to retrieve, carry, and launch aircraft. It is considered to be one of the most stable and stout ships ever built. The aircraft carrier has an overall length of 1,092 feet and features a beam of 134 feet below a flight deck, which is 252 feet wide. The ratio of average width to her length is therefore 0.17. The Ark's ratio of width to length is 0.17, making it look like Yawa aced to his classes at the Naval Academy. In World War II, the battleship Bismarck was the pinnacle of German engineering. It had a ratio of length to width of 0.16. The world's largest ship, weighing in at 261,000 tons, is the supertanker Nock Nevis. It was commissioned as the Seawise Giant, but ran aground in the shallows of the Straits of Hormuz following an Iraqi Exocet missile strike in 1986. When she was refloated, the ship was renamed to distance her from that stigma. History aside, the pride of Japanese shipbuilding is 1,504 feet long and has a 226-foot beam, providing a ratio for the supertanker of 0.15 to 1. Continuing with our analysis, with a fully loaded draft of 80 feet and a freeboard of 30 feet, the hull of the Nock Nevis is 110 feet tall. For these measurements to be compared with those of the Ark, you would need to consider the deckhouse. And even with the Nock Nevis deckhouse being built 5 stories tall, rising 53 feet above the hull, as opposed to the Ark's 2-story superstructure, this still yields a comparative ratio of overall height to length of 0.108 for the tanker and a similar factor of 0.100 for the Ark. To put these findings into perspective, the best-preserved ancient warship from which dimensions are retrievable is the Sweden's Vasa. I have seen this ship. I've been present in a museum that houses it. This vessel, commissioned in 1628, was the largest and most advanced ship of her day, built and designed by the world's most formidable navy. And yet, when she sank on her maiden voyage, not even making her out of Stockholm's sheltered archipelago, she is now been raised from her watery grave by naval architects, and they have determined that the ship's proportions weren't able to withstand windage from the side nor waves. It was just a breezy day, and the ship just funk blew right over. She was 69 meters long, which was 226 feet overall, including her excessive bowsprit. The hull itself was 61 meters. The Vasa was 11.7 meters wide, which is 38 feet, and 52.5 meters high, which is 172 feet, from her keel to the top of her stubby main mast. From keel to stern, she rose 24.1 meters, or about 80 feet. Net of her bowsprit, the unsavory, the unseaworthy and unsavory design, the vessel's ratio of beam to length was a gangly 0.19, and her overall height to overall length, by comparison, was a grotesquely unstable 0.76. Discounting the mast and bowsprit, the Vasa's keel to stern height contrasted with her hull length provided a top-heavy ratio of 0.40, ultimately dooming her. So this was in the 17th century, and the most formidable navy in the world couldn't design a seaworthy vessel. And yet, Yawa's design, his dimensions of the Ark, are almost identical to a modern aircraft carrier and to a supertanker, even to a battleship. By analyzing the Ark's engineering specifications and comparing them to those mankind has only recently been able to understand and achieve, it is evident that the Ark's proportions were nearly 5,000 years ahead of her time. The most logical explanation for this reality is that these words were inspired by someone with more knowledge than was possessed by Noah. Build a roof to the point of a cubit above the completed ark. Place the doorway of the ship in her side. Construct lower decks, a second and third. Now, some translations suggest that God was asking for a second and third deck to be built within the ship, within the hull of the ship. And while I suspect that's true, and prefer this regarding our rendering to a second and third passageway, we can't be sure. The Dead Sea Scroll fragments confirm the location and quantity used here, but not the identity of the object being quantified, whether it's a doorway or decks. So I'm of the conclusion that we're dealing with decks, because when it comes to life, there is only one doorway. There is a multiple doorways to death and destruction, but only one doorway to life, that being Passover. Now, accurately translated, what follows is of profound importance. God has confirmed two critical components of what he intended to accomplish with the flood and why it transpired. Behold, Hannah, pay attention. Look up to me on this. Hannah is the hey, the two letters that repeated in Yahweh's name, two people depicted in the original alphabet, with the letters being drawn, so it's two people standing up, looking up, reaching up to God. Behold, I will bring, Bo, a flood, a mabul, a deluge of overwhelming proportions of water upon the region. Now, I can't imagine that God was capable of doing this without burning lots of fossil fuels and creating global warming. But nonetheless, God managed without fossil fuels or global warming to bring a flood of water upon the region. He didn't say the entire earth. Eretz is the Hebrew word for region, for land, and typically it's used to speak of the land of Yisrael. It's a territory, an area, or ground. So, behold, I will bring a flood of water upon the region, the Eretz, to destroy Shahat, to catch this area, this to deluge, if you will, this pit or basin, causing decay and decomposition, annihilating, wiping out, and laying waste to all related Asher humans, Bashar, people who are preachers and messengers in particular, in whom a spirit was born and lives, chill, resides, moving about, twisting and distorting, causing pain and suffering, anguish and torment, from beneath the heavens, all who are related in the region will expire. Gawa, perish, grasping for breath, becoming empty, hollow corpses. the door being shut on them. So God begins this by telling us he wants us to pay attention. That's always a good idea. When God is speaking, it's really a good idea to henna. Behold, pay attention. He says, I, Annie, will bring, Bo, a flood, a deluge of overwhelming proportions of water upon the region. Now, we're going to find that he did so by causing a welling up of seawater initially because of the Burkle Impact Crater. We were hit by a meteorite right at this moment. That's what caused the deluge, particularly in this region of Mesopotamia. It's absolute proof of it 5,000 years ago. And we will contemplate that later in this program and in future programs. The purpose was to destroy in this pit or basin, to annihilate all related humans, the Kol Asher Bashar, in which there was a spirit, that a ruach that was born and lives from beneath the heavens. That spirit would be the spirit of Hasatan. When Hasatan, the adversary, Hillel ben Shakar by name, Satan, was expelled from heaven, a third of the malach, or messengers, the envoys of Yahweh, left with him. And so they are spiritual entities, and they can possess humans. And so God is saying that the problem here is that humans, with their nesama, were more in league and more in harmony with Satan than were Adam and Chawa, who simply chose improperly after being beguiled by Satan. He's saying that these now are possessed by Satan, because in them that spirit lives. It's a spirit underneath the spiritual realm. Well, welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths today. We have Larry having called in from Florida. Larry's a regular participant in the show, as a regular participant and contributor to the Blog Talk Radio, Yada Ya Radio, a program we do on the Shabbat, where we have been devoted these last 5 or 6 weeks to exposing what Yahweh, God's one and only name, had to say about Sheol, who is the founder of the Christian religion, known as Paul to many, where God called the founder of the Christian religion, Paul, the plague of death. Hello, Larry. Welcome.
Oh, well, good morning, Yada. I heard you said that Yahweh attacked the earth with carbon.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, I mean, he absolutely must have involved global warming. Otherwise, you could not have had a climate change event of this magnitude, right? So
yeah, well,
it must have been burning carbon fuels. Is all I can figure. Maybe the asteroid that I don't think has been named, but the one the meteorite or asteroid that formed the Burkle Impact Crater, which we'll get to in a subsequent program, that is the perfect size, perfect location, and perfect timing to create this regional flood. And the description, because Yahweh even talks about the welling up of seawater being the impetus of the of this regional flood.
That's why I really called that absolute proof.
Yeah,
you know,
so
perhaps
Yahweh, maybe
heck, he proves out what he says because he was there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was there at the time. And the fact is that's the beauty of being spiritual as opposed to being physical. Because a spiritual being is an energy-based being, which means, yes, he was there. He was there at creation. He was there at the flood. He is here now because he can be in all times, at all time. And the reason that is so is Einstein demonstrated this to us regarding light, which is that on a photon of light, time simply is. There is no concept of past, present, or future on a photon of light. That's why, you know, in with this universe being some 30 billion light years across, there is no way for a physical being ever to navigate any of it. But when we're like light, like Yahweh describes himself, you can get from one side to the other side at no time, so speed becomes irrelevant. And as you know, Larry, the whole basis of Yahweh's Torah and prophecy is the fact that he has, because he is light in nature, He has witnessed our future, and so he could report our future to us in our past, which means that his prophecies aren't predictions.
This is science. It's not mind-melding. It's not what we see in people that call themselves spiritualists today.
Right.
I mean, could you call yourself spiritual, Yada? Because I don't call myself spiritual.
I would never use that term. As a matter of fact, when he was speaking of those he was about to annihilate, he called them spiritual. That's what he said. He says they were spiritual. And I'm going to annihilate them because they're spiritual. You know, there is a time when you and I will be a spiritual being, being energy-based. And by spiritual, Yah was very clear to say that if you want to understand what it's like to be spirit, the thing that is in you, that is within your grasp to observe and appreciate, that is the most consistent with being spiritual, is light. And so you will one day, and we will one day be like light. We will be energy, therefore devoid of the limitations of our physical bodies, and therefore we're going to have the same capability that Yahweh has. But
literally what he told Abraham, didn't he? He didn't say. Yeah. He said, your children are going to be like that. And he pointed at mm-hmm. the stars. He didn't say mm-hmm. more numerous than the stars. He right. didn't say like the numbers of the stars. He said like light, didn't he?
Right. Yeah, and even greater than the stars would also be
equivalent.
Yeah, but you know, but greater, out. But greater than the stars, even Rob. Relative to the stars is part of the covenant's promises. The covenant, Yahweh in the covenant promises, as you know, five things. You know, five requirements, there's five promises. The last two promises speak of enlightening and empowering. And so, you know, the stars are a source of great illumination source of energy. And so he's saying, you know, if you can equate to light energy, you're going to be even greater in this regard than those stars are. Again, we're dealing with science, with reality, which is why I'm so glad you called in, Larry. It is true. That's the beauty of Yahweh's word, is that it is understandable. It can be observed. It is verifiable when you understand science.